Good morning. It's nice to be back with you all. Some of you know that, most of you know that I've been away for most of this month. I went to India to see Swami Kriyananda on the last day of February, returned on Thursday. I've been writing a book about his life, and he asked me to come over to work with him on the manuscript. I'm very pleased to say we made enormous progress. And maybe in a matter of a month or so, I'll be finished writing, and soon after, we'll have another book about Swamiji. So I'm very happy about that. I'm understating my happiness. I've been working on this for quite some time, and it'll be lovely to be free of, have it ready for you all, and be free of the project, too. It has kept me a little bit out of the center of the activities of the Sangha now for quite some time. Some of you have only been here since I've been working on the book, and you don't even realize that I used to teach and do other things. So I see the light at the end of the tunnel. The joy of it is that I think the book is really going to be lovely. It's a collection of stories of people's experience with Swami. It's called Swami Kriyananda as we have known him. And with his help and the help of many others who contributed stories, I think it's going to be a real treasure. So stay tuned on that one. So I bring you Swamiji's greetings. He's been very, very busy in India. He's coming here in just a month, and his energy is really wonderful. His physical body is always challenged. He'll be 80 this year, but his spirit isn't. I was listening to today's reading today and sort of putting it together with the experiences I've had, and thinking of this very fine line that we walk on the spiritual path, which is not a simple one, which is, on one hand, we have to always keep in mind the magnitude of the goal, which is literally without limit. The goal is infinity. The consciousness, our own consciousness, will become infinite. Our own consciousness is infinite. We simply don't realize it. That's why we call it self-realization. At the same time, there's a necessity to bring that teaching, which is so far beyond human comprehension, into some kind of form that we can actually live it on a day-to-day basis. Many of the aberrations that set in spiritual life are because one or the other side of this equation is lost. Swamiji has just completed, and it's the completion of a lifetime of service to his guru, a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, which is the commentary that Yogananda wrote in 1951. Not literally, because Swami didn't work from that manuscript, but Swamiji knew Yogananda's commentary because he helped him with it. And so he wrote a commentary on the Gita based on Yogananda's interpretation of it. And that book is now out in India and will be out in America on the 3rd of June when they're having a ceremonial launch in San Francisco. I encourage all of you to come there. Swami will be there himself. But one of the factors of that Gita, Swamiji was commenting about that book. He said, the Indian teaching is the only religion that teaches clearly the concept of self-realization. Moksha is the Sanskrit word for it, which means complete freedom, in which the ego is dissolved and nothing is left but the infinite spirit. Jesus taught moksha. He taught, be ye therefore perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect, and that which I do, ye shall do in greater things. Jesus didn't mince words about it at all, but Christianity no longer teaches moksha. Christianity teaches that you can be devoted to Christ, and by the grace of Christ, and by the sacrifice of Christ, your sins will be forgiven, you will be able to go to heaven. But heaven is pictured as just some kind of expanded ego pleasure in a real sense. Just all the things that we think of as being really fun, we get to do all the time. One of my ex-Catholic friends said when he was a child, the nuns used to promise them if they lived very good lives, they would have a bigger house in heaven. He found that not a very motivating factor. And from that point, he ceased to be good, pretty much, because if that was all he was going to get for it, it wasn't enough for the sacrifice required. Swamiji often jokes that he can hardly think of anything less enjoyable than an eternity as yourself. That sounds like a definition of hell, not heaven. I've been thinking recently, just when I was first on the spiritual path in my early 20s, I joined the monastic order at Ananda Village at that time. The core group was about 10 women. We swelled two or three times that number sometimes, but the core group was always that same group. The very early years were extremely primitive. Swamiji bought bare land. Just think of it, bare land, nothing on it. And none of us had any real money. And never in the history of Ananda have we ever had a wealthy patron. It's all been just squozing out like the bottom of a toothpaste tube, a dollar at a time. And our dwelling places were mostly trailers and a few teepees. Most of the women lived in trailers, for which we paid $100 or $150. They were what people would call travel trailers, something you would hook on the back of a car. And we'd had them scattered around the woods, and our temple was this teepee, canvas on the outside, plastic lining on the inside. It was pretty functional. And every morning at 5:30, we'd go in there and meditate together for a little less than an hour. And just doing this day after day for almost a decade, the sense of unity among our consciousness was profound. And I used to often, in an odd sort of way, wonder how we knew when we came out of meditation which personality to take with us. You know, you'd sort of all come in there together, and to a certain extent, you'd shed your ego sense. But when you walked out, you always walked out the same. Of course, I know the metaphysics of it, of the ego and the chakras and the vrittis and all the things like that, but still it used to puzzle me. And even still to this day, it's so odd to me the way we remain ourselves no matter what happens. And the fact of the matter is we are that same self through many incarnations. Swamiji was talking about looking at his own baby pictures and just seeing those little eyes staring out of him. And as he put it, it's the same old fellow. When he was a child, there are these little pictures of him when he's about two or three, and there's this very determined look on his face. And he said his father, he used to have this very determined look sometimes as a child, and they wanted to capture it on camera. You know how doting parents are. He was the firstborn son. So his father handed him an apple. This is all at the photography session. And then took the apple away from him and held it just behind the camera so that Swamiji went for the apple like this. And then they took a picture of that face so they could capture it for the parent's heart. And just that determination to whatever goal you're going to get, that's where we're going to go. I used to keep my own portrait on the wall, and it was a picture of myself when I was about 6 months old, because there was just this sort of look in my eye that I wanted to maintain, just this ready for anything sort of look of here we are again and we're going to go for it again, let's see what happens. And there is that, you glance at yourself in a mirror, you see yourself walking down the street, and what do you know, there you are. And people go mad over that thought. I mean, people literally lose their minds over the sheer pressure of the inescapability of consciousness and the inescapability of all of our egoic considerations. There's a stage on the spiritual path, literally, everyone at one time or another goes insane. You often go insane. I'm speaking over many incarnations. I'm not saying that all crazy people are spiritual. Some crazy people are just crazy. But there is there's a kind of metaphysical madness that sets in. When we reach a certain point on the spiritual path over many lifetimes, where we understand the magnitude of the task, and we understand the absolute inescapability of the task, and we don't want to do it. And so we just take a little holiday, because we're too conscious to live an ordinary worldly life in which we ignore the demands of spirit, and we're not conscious enough to embrace them. So we just go bye-bye for a while, and just go off into a subconscious world of our own making. And gradually, we come out of it for a very simple reason. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. As an antidote to pain, living in a subconscious reality that doesn't meet the rest of the world doesn't work. And that's the only thing that's wrong with it. That's the only thing wrong with everything except seeking God. It's very simply, it doesn't work. Man is motivated by one desire. Swamiji wrote the book, God is for Everyone. And it's a very simple thesis, and he was rewriting a book that Master wrote, The Science of Religion. A very simple thesis, which is everyone is seeking to escape suffering and to experience bliss. And even the worst criminal in the world has that as a desire. There was a time when a man contacted us who was imprisoned in the San Mateo County Jail, I guess it would be, or City Jail or something like that. His circumstances were unusual, and he was a number of years in that facility, which is really temporary. He then eventually went to a state prison. But he called us up because he was interested in the spiritual path, and he asked us to come and visit him. So David and I went into a jail, which is not something in this life that we'd ever experienced. And that jail over there is like something out of a movie. Parts of it are. It's this long cement hallway, and then there are these holding tanks, and then there are these wide bars, and you walk down the center aisle, and there are people standing there behind these bars, just like a film. And you know, I walked way in the center of the aisle, you know, just right down the middle, because the vibrations were unusual, to say the least. And it was so striking to me, because people would, because there's not much happening, so somebody coming down the aisle is a big story. So everybody would come to the front and generally, just like in the movies, grip the bars and look out. And it was so dynamic to see, because many of those individuals, as soon as they get out of jail, will commit the same crimes and get back in jail. You could just see it in their consciousness. But what was so dynamic was that their prison was so tangible. You could just see them sort of fighting against the bars like this, and they were fighting drug addiction and difficult upbringings and rebellious attitudes, all kinds of things. You could just see it just walking down the aisle, almost all of them. I'm not being stereotypical. I mean, I was looking at people. I was looking at their consciousness. And I thought, how much they are just like everyone, that we're all captured, trapped behind these bars of our own inability to transcend our own limitations. And we suffer in exact proportion to the degree to which our egos keep us from knowing our true selves. And as I was starting to say at the beginning, on the spiritual path, what Jesus is saying in this chapter, he says, you know, the scriptures say don't murder. Well, that's not so hard to understand. Most of us, even though we might become angry on occasion, are past the karmic point where we would actually take someone else's life. But Jesus just brushes that aside. It's not sufficient to say, oh, I'm not going to murder someone. If you wish harm to anyone, with any part of your being, then you have still broken the same commandment. And then Swami expands that further. Why? Because we are one with everything. And every negative impulse that goes through our consciousness that in any way thinks that happiness will come to us by imposing our negativity on anything outside of ourselves or by experiencing it all, to that extent, we are condemned. It's ourselves that we condemn. And so we live this life of a constant desire for this tremendous freedom. When I was younger, the only ambition I had as a young woman was that I wanted to have children, which is one of the things in my life that I never have done. And it was an enormously strong desire in me. And it was very interesting because I lost that desire almost exactly the same day that I found Ananda and found the spiritual path. Now, it's not necessarily that those two things would go together, because many devotees have children. I'm not speaking against it. But there was a simultaneous realization in my mind that what I was looking for was to expand my sense of self. That what I was suffering from was this extraordinary sense of confinement. And I just thought, if I multiplied physically, you know, just sort of made more of them, that somehow I would feel less confined. And this sort of terrible realization came to me that no matter how many more there were, it would still be a finite number. There would still be an edge to it, even if the edge was larger than just myself. You understand what I mean? That sooner or later we would run up against that edge, and as long as that edge would be there, we would suffer. Yogananda made the extremely dynamic statement. He said, I killed Yogananda long ago. No one dwells in this temple now but God. Now, there's this promise, which is the answer to the kind of metaphysical madness I was speaking to. Let me sort of bring this back to a focus. I was walking down the street just, you know, yesterday virtually, just a couple of days ago. And a tinge of that metaphysical madness touched me. There's a certain, you know, everybody has different things in their background, and I don't think I've been physically ill in my life, in my lifetimes, as close as I've been mentally ill. I understand that. I understand how the mind gets away from you. Not that I'm inclined that way, but I do understand it. And I felt, just for a moment, this sense of absolute terror that I would never escape from myself. Do you know what I mean? I've had the opportunity many times in my life to take seclusion, which is just to be by myself and be silent. And I always say to people, sometimes people take short seclusions, 3 or 4 days, 5 days. I can't take a short seclusion because it takes about 4 days for Asha to go away. And as long as she's present, the seclusion isn't nearly as much fun. And she's very tenacious, and so she always hangs around extremely tightly. And about the fourth day or so, I go away. And the ego just surrenders a little bit, and then I can enjoy a week or 10 days more of just freedom from self. But every so often, that terrible fear will come to me that I'm always going to be trapped in this small awareness. And this, like I said, this panic comes over me. And the antidote to that is faith in God and Guru. And all suffering, ultimately, one way or another, is that fear that whatever it is will never end. The grief over the loss of something that you desired, the aging of the body, the inevitable loss of youth, illness if it descends upon you, or profound disappointment. Life is really a gamble. There's just no way around it. Swamiji speaks so cynically about these things. He said, you get married, you never know who you're really going to get. He said, you know, you have children. He said, and you really have no idea who they're going to be. You conceive them and you grow their little bodies, the woman inside her womb, and the man contributes the sperm. But you don't know who's coming. And maybe it'll be somebody who'll be very close to you. Maybe it'll be somebody who'll be a terrible torture to you. Or we set off with all these ambitions, and you never know. There's just no certainty to it. And most people, including devotees, just hide from that fact. We just hide from it. We fill our time with other things. But ultimately, sooner or later, in one incarnation or another, we have to look at the straight fact that unless and until we master this ego and liberate ourselves from the limitations of self, the bliss that we know is ours will never be ours. And this is where the masters come. And this is where we have to have, as I started to say at the beginning, we have to have these two sides to the spiritual path. The one side of it is moksha, that we understand that nothing less than absolute freedom will ever make us happy. And we can play both sides of it, and we do. We pretend that we can keep little parts of the ego. This little harmless thing, that little harmless thing, this little predilection, this affection for intellectuality, this preference for aesthetic values, you know, this pleasure in academia, this, you know, fun in serving others, whatever it might be. Mother Teresa, who was such an extraordinary example of service and really did an enormous amount to uplift the world by her example, she captured the world's imagination because she did something that people could see. What she did with her devotion to God was she went into places that frightened other people, and she accepted tasks that were repulsive to other people, and she embraced them wholeheartedly, and she had such an uplifting spirit, she inspired hundreds, probably thousands, of other otherwise ordinary men and women to also do those same things, to go into slums and to work with sick and dying people like that. So that captured people's imagination. But Mother Teresa never saw herself as serving the poor. And that was the great secret of her ability to do it. When people asked her about serving the poor, she just looked at them and said very simply, I'm not serving the poor. She said, I'm serving Jesus. I'm not helping the poor. She said, I'm doing what Christ asked me to do. And now she's really defining what it is, because even people become ego involved in helping the poor. And you earn good karma, there's no question about it. It's certainly better than not doing it. But it doesn't liberate us unless we understand that no one dwells in this temple now but God. And there's a kind of a point you reach, a certain cul-de-sac, which is a little dangerous on the spiritual path, where as Master put it, he put it so sweetly, he said, where you do good merely because it's your habit to do so. And you're a good person and a generous person because it's become your habit to do so. In other words, the ego has built itself around that reality. Sister Gyanamata said, at first, Sister said, I couldn't understand why I had to give up everything. Even things, she said, that harmed no one. And she gradually realized that some of the tests that her guru sent her were designed for one purpose only, which was to cause her to give up every remnant of self except self-realization. So the path that we walk and the path that Swami Kriyananda has indeed been brilliant in outlining for us, and he was talking about the Bhagavad Gita itself, the commentary that he wrote. And he was commenting that his own spiritual life has always been very grounded. He said when he was a young monk, he said some of the monks would have the most extraordinary experiences. He talked about one monk there who left the path. Swami said he'd often come into the room and the man would be absolutely motionless on the bed without breath, and he would be traveling in astral realms and he would tell Master about all these visions he had. Swami just said nothing like that ever happened to him at all. And for several reasons, some of them are karmic and his Master explained it to him. But the other was, as Swami himself said, so that the teachings he would offer would be grounded in everyday life. Because if God can't be found right where we are standing, where do we think he will be found? But he won't be found until we recognize that every single thing that I cling to as my self-definition that isn't one with the Spirit, sooner or later must be overcome. That even those little things that harm no one harm us because we hold on. And so Christ gives us this instruction. If you condemn another, you're condemned to hellfire. If you're angry at your brother, you know, you're the one who is condemned. But it's not about hellfire. It's about bliss. It's about becoming so free, just like we were affirming today. I'm not the crashing waves. I'm not the storms on the surface. When while we were doing that affirmation, if you really take it in, you see on the surface of life, all of these things happen. But what am I in myself? And this is where Yogananda, who had this enormously dynamic personality, who accomplished great things with great will and with great determination, he was not at all passive or unimpressive or small in his impact. He was enormous in his impact. But then he said, but there's nobody there. He was, as Swami Kriyananda described himself, Swami said about himself, he said, I consider Swami Kriyananda an event for which I am responsible. And not it's not me. It's not I who am acting. It is merely the Spirit who is acting through me. There's no ego to tie that to. And all of us long, with a desperate longing, if we allow ourselves to know it, most of the time we hide our desperation. Thoreau said it quietly, most men live lives of quiet desperation, he said. When I read that as a teenager, it was so depressing, I couldn't bear it. But in fact, it's true. And whether or not we are really desperate, most of us are not, it's just not practical. Just before I found the spiritual path, I was becoming desperate and I was thinking about having a nervous breakdown. But it occurred to me that it would take a lot of time and probably cost a lot of money. And at the end of it, I would be exactly where I was standing. So I just thought there was no point in it. You know, the memory of metaphysical madness was quite close, and I thought, been there, done that, you know, we're not going to go there again. But there was this thought, which is, I know there's something more. I know there's bliss. I know that I was born for a greater destiny than just ordinary life. And I don't mean that in the world's terms. I mean it in God's terms and only God's terms. That's what the message of the Masters is. Ever and again through your awakened sons, the answer comes. But as many as received him, to them gave he the power. What keeps us from receiving him? Our lack of interest or our attachment to something else. That's all. It's a very sweet and very simple and a very intense and an absolutely demanding reality, which is every moment of the day, we choose the infinite, we choose the limited, or we choose the direction of infinity, we choose the direction of the ego. Master said, take care of the minutes. It's a profound teaching. Take care of the minutes, and the incarnations will take care of themselves. Everything that we are right now is just a collection of every single choice we've made through millions of lifetimes up till now. Everything you're going to be tomorrow is nothing less and nothing more than the choices we make moment by moment today. It's really so simple, not easy, but simple. It's very important on the spiritual path. Don't mix up complexity for truth. It's very simple. Choose God, God alone, with all my heart, with all my mind, with all my soul, and with all my strength. I choose thy love.